Welcome, everybody. Thanks so much for coming to Fat Claws, Women We Admire. We appreciate your support. Real quickly, why we want to hold in a Halloween bucket? It's for the raffle. Please enter. And those of you on the phone, if there are any people on the phone, please do mute. We're excited today to have Dean Connolly here, all the way from Southern California. And some of you know that she is also the president designate of Cal State Long Beach. Congratulations. And she was supposed to speak here last fall, but there were travel delays, and we're so glad and grateful that she actually came all the way back to do it.
Last night. I didn't fly in this morning.
All right, and here today to introduce her is Vice Chair of PACSTAL, Margaret Wu.
Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. Jane Connolly has been the Dean and Professor of Counseling, Clinical, and School Psychology at UC Santa Barbara's Diverse Graduate School of Education since January 2006. Stella mentioned she served as Interim Chancellor at UC Riverside from December 2012 through August 2013, and that's where I first had the pleasure of meeting Dean Connolly and hearing her speak. And as Stella mentioned, earlier this year she was appointed president of CSU Long Beach. She is the first woman appointed to that position and is expected to begin her position sometime in July. So we're sorry to lose her from the UC system, but glad she is still in California and leading our sister institution, and really pleased to really pleased that she took time out of her scheduled to come speak to us today. Dean Connolly is a nationally recognized expert in educational issues. She's a first-generation college student herself and spent much of her professional career in educational psychology, finding ways to improve access to education for disadvantaged students and promoting their success. She earned her bachelor's degree in psychology cum laude at the College of New Rochelle and a PhD from the University of Texas at Austin. In addition to being dean at UCSB, she has also served as dean of the College of Education and Human Development at Texas A&M University and taught at University of Nebraska-Lincoln, Syracuse University, and Texas Women's University. So without further ado, Dean Connolly.
Thank you. And thanks to everybody here and those on the phone. I'm looking at the phone thing now for those on the phone. It's really an honor to speak with you today. I don't get a chance to reflect very much on my career.
As you can see, I haven't been able to hold a job. I just keep changing. And so it's a rare moment to do that. And I thought the chance to talk to you today was particularly great, not only because I tried to do it in November, but I am embarking on a new adventure. So I think some time for reflection is really good. So that's supposed to be me reflecting on the puzzles of my life, you know. But of course, I'm very interested in your questions, your comments, things that you might have noticed now that there's a woman at the head of the Starship UC. You know, there's been a change in the force to kind of mix my movie metaphors there. It'd be very interesting. And I've been thinking about that because one of the questions asked to me when I first was selected as president of Cal State Long Beach, I was on a phone, and there was reporters somewhere else, and they had all called in. And one of the questions was, well, how will it be different, because now there's a woman in charge? And I thought, it's 2014. How would I possibly answer that question? I will stand for all women, and here's what we do. But,
I could understand that they would have that feeling, although, in all honesty, I didn't know I was the first woman until I read the headline. You know, they send it to you via email. They say, the announcement's been made, and the headline was, first woman to lead, you know. Oh, great. My brother immediately called. I have two older brothers. One brother immediately called. He said, I think you've made a big mistake. You know, you don't want to be the first woman. But as I will share with you, I've been the first woman several times. I am currently, for example, even in the University of California, the only woman academic dean at UC Santa Barbara. I was the only woman academic dean at Texas Women's University. At Texas A&M. Which that wouldn't surprise you, but probably University of California, it does surprise you a little bit. And the other great thing about getting to come back, as I mentioned, you know, it's changed since in when I was coming in November, I was just back from a chancellor experience, and getting used to the fact that things were the same.
having that Santa Barbara, but I was a different person, and how was I going to manage that? So it's nice to be able to talk with you a little bit about a career transition when everything was going right. You know, there's no particular reason to leave Santa Barbara, but why do that?
So I'm going to organize my comments to you, pretty brief comments, along kind of inputs and processes and outcomes. And I'm doing that because I don't want you to think that my career is the reflection of a wandering, aimless academic who just, you know, went from place to place, although there might be some truth to that. But my research area, one of my research areas, is on resilience and well-being and thriving. And we think a lot about the genetic contributions that kids get as kind of either win or lose the genetic lottery, and you have to deal with that, and then family context and, you know, how that either advantages certain young people, doesn't guarantee them anything, but it advantages them and it disadvantages others. Again, it doesn't make it impossible, but it makes for a longer struggle forward, just like perceptions of gender do the same thing, or perceptions about disability, or perceptions about color, or any number of things. So I actually was given a lot of kind of gifts that I had nothing to do with. So this is not a picture of me, but when I saw it, I thought of it, and I'm showing now a picture of a girl for the people on the phone, a girl who's pretending to be Supergirl. I did, as a child, I grew up in the Bronx, New York, and I went to a small little parish Catholic school, and we would walk home about 7 blocks, and there was a candy store along the way, so we all stopped at the candy store, and I always bought the Supergirl comic books. So just when I saw this, it made me think about it. So I would say that for no effort of my own, I was kind of born on second base, right? Because I was born with a certain genetic predisposition to be smart, healthy, easy temperament. I know that because I have a twin sister. And we're fraternal twins. We're dizygotic twins. And the family legend is that she was so tough. She didn't eat. She didn't sleep. You know, she had ear infections. So I, in contrast, was the easy one. And, you know, we've studied a lot now about infant's temperament. You know, you're easy, you're hard, you're slow to warm. I was born easy, so that's good. Good for my mother, hard for my sister, as a matter of fact, you know. Now, my family was in a kind of check-to-check financial reality. My dad was red meters for the Edison Company in New York City. He was the son of immigrants. He hadn't even finished elementary school because his father died when he was quite young, and he drove milk trucks, I remember, but then worked for almost 50 years for the Edison Company. And very late in his career became the supervisor of the guys who read the meters. My mother also didn't go to high school, but she did go to a kind of a business school and was actually on Wall Street as a bookkeeper during the crash. So she had stories about that. So they didn't have a strong education, but what they a lot of education, but what they did have was an extended family in the Bronx, a couple of weird ones in Queens, and then, you know, way far away in New Jersey. That was the extent of my world, you know. You know, the occasional visit to New Jersey, and then we never really went to Queens. That was impossible. Nobody could find that if you came from the Bronx. But they were very connected to each other, and so I didn't grow up very attentive to the financial difficulty. I grew up wishing I had stuff, but, you know, I wanted the kind of sweater that I saw other girls would have, and I couldn't get that kind of sweater or that, you know, or I had one skirt. Or we wore uniforms to school, so it wasn't us. So I remember that part, but, you know, the advantage I had was to be embedded in this very tight-knit family, and also with a very strong religious background, a very strong religious connection to each other. And this, you know, we study this now, that we know that people, you don't have to be religious to have this positive effect, but it's really helpful for children to be brought up to believe in something bigger than themselves, more important than they are, to see a transcendent value. And, you know, this religious orientation gave that to me. And, in fact, I went to Catholic school. You mentioned the College of New Rochelle. That was a Catholic, Catholic women's liberal arts school in Westchester County, about 15 miles from my house in the Bronx. It was a big deal. Got to go to Westchester. And I had the same nuns for 16 years, the Ursuline nuns. And this, again, was the luck of the draw, that these nuns were in the parish. These were nuns who were very progressive, feminist nuns. They, and I would just say as a shorthand to describe, after 16 years of Catholic education, my mother would often say, "I sent you to Catholic school and you believe that?" And, well, this is what the nuns, we had
nuns who, were smart. They all had at least master's degrees when they were teaching us. These were well-prepared people. And, interestingly enough, their slogan, I'm sure there's a better word for it, was Serviam, I will serve. And, in the story, in the biblical story they told us, the good angel said, Serviam, I will serve. The bad angel said, non-serviam. And you know what happened to them, right? So we were connected to this notion of service. And I would say that's probably made all the difference in my life.
So I mentioned I'm the first generation to go to college, but you can see that I didn't have, I didn't, like so many of the Long Beach students, even the Santa Barbara students throughout the state, I didn't have that kind of chaotic struggle in families. And I got a full scholarship to go to school. So when we talk about, how do low-income kids get to school, I was offered and took, obviously, a full scholarship, and I also had a Regents scholarship. So I was able to go to which school that at that point was considered a very prestigious kind of elite school. So the other thing that I have, and I don't know if any of you are aunties or uncles in the audience, but my father came from a family of five children, but only he had, he's the oldest, he had children, and his youngest brother had children. The rest were either unmarried or had no children. So I can look back now and realize, I didn't know it, I took it for granted when it was happening. I had all these aunties and uncles who thought we were the best thing in the world. Twins. This is so, look, they dressed alike. By the way, my twin sister's about 5'3" and weighs like 3 pounds. So she looked good in the things we were dressed alike on. So if you're aunties and uncles, don't underestimate the power of that, because you're not as critical of your nieces and nephews as parents have to be critical of their sons and daughters, because they feel more responsible for that. I also, besides this, I mentioned Catholic education, but the other part of it, I was in women's schools my entire educational career until graduate school. Now, there's mixed research on this, and it's really hard to tease out, but I would say that the fact that from first grade through college, that I was in women's-only environments gave me a level of confidence. And really, I can tell you, I'll mention Syracuse University. I was the only woman on that psychology faculty. And I was, at first, I thought it was a joke. I mean, the sexism, I couldn't, if you don't ever experience it, you think, well, that guy's weird.
So that advantage of having a women's-only education, I think, something important, and also many mentors along the way, and probably too many filling to mention, but
some of you may know the name Joan Leitzel. She became vice chancellor, or executive vice chancellor, at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. She was the first woman, and I was there from 84 to 96. She was the first woman I knew in higher ed leadership, and I remember going to her job talk, essentially. And I learned something from other amazing from her over time, but one was when she'd be asked a question, and it would be one of these questions like, do you believe in diversity? That kind of question. And she would always answer with, well, here's the program that I, facilitated. She always gave a specific example. And so you really felt like you were never getting this gloss of just babble about stuff. And I've really tried to
model that. And she, I talked to her many, many times. She went on to be the president of the University of Vermont or New Hampshire or one of those states, you know, one of those little states like that. And I must mention also,
you have interesting, events in your life that I was dean at Texas A&M. There was a rule then that you could be dean 10 years, and so after 10 years, I'd so what will I do? And I was looking around, and I applied to Santa Barbara, but then there was a family illness, and I had also applied for some provost jobs. And so when my husband's father got very ill, we just decided we'd stay. We're not going to move because we didn't want to leave his mother. And so we made that decision, pulled out of the searches. Then Henry Yang started calling me, chancellor at Santa Barbara. And he called me every week. Then he called me twice a week. Then he called me three times a week from May until August. And then finally, I was like, well, are you going to come or not? You know, by this time, Kali's father was better. And, well, I guess he's called me so much, I guess I better go, you know. But, you know, and that has, of course, made a big difference in my life, choosing to come to Santa Barbara. And when Amy Doerr called me and said, would I consider being the interim chancellor at, or being a candidate to do that, interim chancellor at Riverside, you know, another phone call that came in an unexpected way that certainly made all the difference because then I tried the third phone call with Tim White calling me in September saying, would you apply to be the president of Long Beach? And of course, Tim, as you will recall, was the chancellor at Riverside.
So although we don't really know each other very much personally, he was obviously getting a lot of intelligence about me because he was talking. So that was good. So sometimes these events happen that were certainly unpredictable. So I've talked a little bit about inputs and processes, you know, and I think the outcome for me that has been so fortunate is that I've had the luxury, because of good mentors and great university homes, of having a focus on work and not on career. And so when these phone calls have come, I've been interested in the work, but I hadn't had to worry too much about what the next step would be beyond, you know, your assistant, your associate, your full professor, that kind of thing. And, I don't know that that's the best way, but I just say it's been a relief to me that the work has always been of most importance. So I've mentioned some of my universities. I could tell you a story about each one, about what I learned about gender and leadership at each one. I'll just give you shorthand. I've mentioned Syracuse. That's the first time I actually ran into sexism. So after 3 years, I did lose my sense of humor about it, but at least at first, that was a joke. I show this in part because the other, happy thing that happened to me was I got married the second time to the right person. First time, no, but the second time, yes. And when we got married, we said, we're both academics, we both want to be professors, how will we manage this? So we established a 3-year no wine contract. In other words, so I got the first job offer at Syracuse University. So the deal was, Kali came with me, and he could not wine for 3 years. But then it would be his choice, and I would go with him. 3 years, we're out of there. He's a Texan, you know, we're Syracuse. No sun. So we were the early, he was like the petri dish for seasonal affective disorder before it was recognized as a thing. So we went back to Texas, and at Texas Women's University, I learned that just as women are in charge, that it's not necessarily an egalitarian place. That's all I'll say. I thought when women did it, it would be better. Well, University of Nebraska taught me the value of having a scholarly context and high performance expectations, because there people were excited when you did well. You know, they celebrated you. They wanted to be involved with you. I've been at other places where you were kind of nervous if you did too well, you know. Texas A&M, that was a school that until the late 60s had been an all-male school. And actually, one of the department chairs I had
Norman Heads I had, he would describe it as the female element came in 1968.
I always want to know what meant by element.
Yeah, he didn't seem unhappy about it. And then, of course, when I was at Texas A&M, we had a big strategic planning process, and you'll be not surprised, but I hope flattered to know that a lot of the aspirational goals were actually discovered by looking at the UC system. So I said, well, Berkeley has this, well, we should have that, or UCLA has, you know. So it was a kind of very, I often describe this pragmatic, Aggie way of doing things. Berkeley has that, they have how many in that chair? Let's get it. You know, and I'd say, well, there might have been more process. Psychologists are good at thinking about the process. And so the University of California was looming up very large in my life because I had been involved in and had a leadership position in this role in this strategic planning. So the chance to come to California was great. And by the way, it is Santa Barbara. There's that. And then, as I mentioned, this chance to go to Riverside. I couldn't do colors there because we do plaid at Riverside, you know, so I couldn't figure that out. So each place really did give me a lot of learning, and certainly one important, among many, but one important thing for University of California is what it's like to be in a big system, you know. And, you know, it's very frustrating at times, but then you see the power of the big system, and so it's really a big advantage too. So I think I'm counting on that to help me in the CSU system. So, you know, as I said, Amy Dorr invited me to be considered. Mark Udoff chose me to be the interim chancellor. When I went to UCR, I was very public that I wasn't going to be a candidate for it. I didn't think that would be so good, but I fell in love with that campus. Absolutely fell in love with it. You know, you see the good things that are going on there. The search committee did not beg me to stay. I say that much to you. And so, it was, you know, but here I was, you know, I could go back there. Not so bad. You know. But it did cause me to reflect on, I was doing a really good job at Riverside. What is it? Now, the number one reason is they found a really good person. Guy with Kim Wilcox, fabulous, Chancellor Wilcox, fabulous experience, was on a campus with a medical school, just wonderful. He also interviewed, now I couldn't do those things, but he had also interviewed for four other presidential positions. And he talked to me about that experience. So it's not about his life experience, which is obviously the more influential, but about your what you learn by interviewing to be a chancellor or a president. So as I said, it wasn't a bad deal. It wasn't a bad gig to go back there. But something I did figure out is that I have some tendencies that have actually worked well for me, generally, not to try to fill up a room, but really to share the space with others. And I think that's, you know, not an uncommon gender expectation, right? Whereas presidents and chancellors are expected to fill up the room, you know. So I also have a dislike of taking credit for stuff because everything's a team effort, right? But I know and you know that many teams don't work unless you measure them constantly, right? But it would not be in my style to say, I made that happen. I would be talking about everybody else who made it happen. Well, as I said, this makes people like me better. But it's not, you know, it's my speculation. You can tell me what you think. I don't think it was the best way to present me as kind of big leadership person. So, and I'd say to the women in the room, you know, there's a study as recent as 2013 from Northwestern, very clever study of comparing women and men's behavior in workplace. And how the negative evaluations women are given for the exact same behavior that's given positive evaluations of men. And if you haven't seen the study, they actually do a computer morphing so that the two people presented are almost exactly alike. And so the woman is narcissistic, she's shrill, she's, you know, the man cares about himself, he's assertive. So this has been, research has been like this for, you know, since the 60s, certainly, since it's been done. So there's a somewhat narrow, behavioral repertoire available to women. But, you know, you have to, you know, I would say I have tried to learn to transcend that. Because at a certain level, you can pretty much do whatever you want, right? You know, if you're the president, you get to be bigger. You get to, you know, no. So when Tim White asked me to apply, I very specifically tried to think about how I might redo myself a little bit in interviews. I couldn't redo other things about me, but I could do the interview differently. And so I did actually talk, I think, more assertively about things I'd accomplished. You know, I didn't say nobody ever helped me, you know. And I talked about some really difficult things I'd done at UCR, personnel things, ethical situations that I had encountered, and I think felt more comfortable taking credit for that. And I think that, you know, gives the search committee confidence in that. So here's my official picture. See my LB? I don't wear that when I'm here, but I have a Long Beach thing. So my official last day at UC is July 14th. Official first day is July 15th. At CSU. So it's very exciting. And as I mentioned, I'm reminded frequently that I'm the first woman to do this. Now, Henry Yang has been a great mentor and supporter to me. For example, when I was offered the UCR experience, I would not have gone if the chancellor said to me, don't go, right? I mean, if your chancellor says, no, I don't want you to go, and your dean, you stay. But in fact, it was just the opposite. And he likes to give me advice, but he always gives me advice using Chinese proverbs. So I understand some, and I don't understand others. I told some of you the story that I have accused him of making these up. He has so many. And he always says, 4,000 years of history? There's a lot of proverbs. You know? So he told me, and this is what I hope I understand, but I think about. He says, well, there's two kind of emperors, and meaning chancellors, those who build a wall, and they're remembered for that wall. You know. Then there's the kind of chancellor that builds the well, you know, builds gradually for the welfare of his subjects over time, and this might take 10 years or 20 years, and remember, he's the 20-year UC chancellor. And people can look from when you started to when you end that things were much better. But that's an incremental, slow process. And I reflected a lot on that. Certainly my own value system would be on the ladder. You know, your best contribution as a leader is to constantly improve the situation that your staff, your followers, the participants in your organization experience and get from your organization. I also know, though, now in our more sound bites and headline world, there's some value to finding a few really small walls to build because people want to be able to hang things on your leadership. So I'm thinking about that. And I think for the Long Beach State University specifically, you know, this is a place that just a decade ago had a 20% graduation rate. Now it's 60%. So they have taken the notion of student success very, very seriously. And given my own background that I've shared with you, you know, my life, my family's life, totally changed because of access to higher education. And that's true for my sister, who's a principal of a high school. My oldest brother is a physicist. You know, our lives are different because we got great educations, all, by the way, paid for by somebody else. I have another brother, the one who called me and said, don't take that Long Beach job because you're the first one. He was a New York City cop. He finished high school, but as he always mentions, he retired when he was 40 and the rest of us are still working. So this long-term commitment to student success that Long Beach has and certainly is shared on many of our campuses, but this is a place that has a long, you know, there's a struggle. There's a way to. There's things to do there. It's very attractive to me,
because I think this is the best ticket to a middle-class life, even though we worry about the disappearance of the middle class, and that income inequality in the United States is the biggest threat to our democracy. I think we see it in Supreme Court decisions now, and we see it all over, that, you know, when money becomes speech and fewer people have access to it, there's trouble. So I don't get involved in the politics, but I think I could be involved in getting people at least access to middle class and good professions. So I think that's, I can see that as an important purpose. And I've been working on that as a dean of education for the last almost 18 years, I guess, now. And the thing is that I can work on that in my own organization, but when you're trying to work with the public schools, you're not in charge of that organization. So my time at Riverside gave me that insight that it was easier to do some of this when you were in charge instead of trying to convince all the superintendents and the principals and the teachers. So we'll see. I'll report back to you in a few years how easy it is. But then how do you do that? How do you really do that in an organization? How do you, make change? And, we could have whole semester-long or quarter-long courses on this, but I think you do it, and it's back to Chancellor Yang's two kinds of emperors. I think you do it by having a very deliberate, purposeful, persistent focus on building healthy communities that you're in charge of. So you can't make people do things. You can't make them do the right thing. You can barely stop them from doing the wrong things, right? But you can foster organizational norms and expectations and that make the right people flourish and probably discourage the wrong people from staying. And these, I'm going to show you just these two slides, and just because some people are on the phone, I'll read it to you, that this is kind of a compilation from years of organizational research. So if anybody's interested, I can give you an enormous bibliography behind each of these. So healthy communities, appropriate autonomy. Biggest mistake people make is to micromanage, or you just send people out to do things that they have no background to do, right? So appropriate autonomy, very important. Many opportunities for self-development. And in budget crunch times, that's usually the first thing that goes, that training opportunities. But in fact, people stay and do better in organizations where they know they can do better. A sense of belonging. What do we do to create identity? How do we create the Long Beach identity or the Santa Barbara identity? We're thinking a lot about that now because of our recent debacle in Isla Vista. So the identity used to be party school, then it became home of 5 Nobel laureates. Now we're back to party school at the moment, so there's a lot of hand-wringing going on. But it's interesting that the students, our students, the Gauchos, say, it wasn't us, it was outsiders. So I don't know if they're completely honest about that, but the good news is it shows a sense of identity. They're embarrassed. They're embarrassed that this is the headline about this school. Well, that's what you hope for, because at least that provides you for the basis for change. Then. So what are we going to do? What are we going to do about that? Recognition for success. In many organizations, the only thing you hear is when you do something wrong, right? So there's no celebration. There's no norms or structures set up to celebrate success. And then interesting and satisfying work, and that's related to self-development. Do you think about people and try to give them access to new things and things they can feel good about? Clear, challenging, attainable goals. You have to set a bar for people and then give them feedback. You're doing great, or you had this other step to do. This is one of the biggest failings of most organizations. You really don't get constructive feedback. You don't get authentic feedback. I can say 8 years of being a dean, nobody ever tells me how I'm doing. Now, it doesn't matter too much. By the time you're a dean, you better figure out. But there's probably some things that I think. So I, on the other hand, tell people all the time how I think they're doing. Adequate resources, they've been working on that. And, we've all gone through this budget situation in the last 5 years that has, brought that to our attention, how hard it is to do a good job if you don't have the resources in people or in money or in connections to
make things happen. And then to look always for your own rules. We were just talking about this, before the thing. Sometimes we make up rules for our organizations that actually prevent us from doing a good job, and there are rules. So I'm always on the lookout for, did we make that up? Really? That's stupid. Did we make that up? We could stop that. So, you know, these will be self-evident to us, but I can tell you if you look into the research, you find how few organizations are actually would be characterized in this way. And so I try every day, and it's true, I do, to think about, this list or some part of this list. Say, well, what am I doing around this, you know, this goal? But the other thing that I think has helped me is when things go wrong, it has helped me to think that there's a problem here, that it's not an individual problem. It's not just a personal problem that has happened, that person is a screw-up. But, you know, but I've learned to think first, what in the organization did not support, you know, appropriate behavior? And, I can see it, I have a new assistant, and the usual thing when new assistants happen, you know, the funny little faux pas. And it's always because I haven't told her. I just didn't say that really what I need is X. I just was assuming that somehow she read my mind. So, you know, so it helps to keep, it has helped me as a leader to keep these eight things as explanatory concepts and as goals rather than individual, evaluating individuals. And that, there's a whole bunch of psychology around that too. The other thing I'd offer to you is don't keep score if you're a leader, you know, in that way of being unforgiving and holding grudges. Because at the end of the day, you'll be so weighed down by that you won't have any energy to go. And there are a lot of people who, in fact, do not elevate the practice of forgiveness to the level they should. Now, that probably is a benefit of, you know, raised a Catholic. We had confession. This is great. In there, you were good there for a while. So forgiveness is a big part of my thing. And the other thing is to have the long view. Now, you've seen my work history. You might say, well, Jane, you have not had the long view. But actually, at each of those organizations, we have remained friends and colleagues. At most of those organizations continue to publish with them, write with them, have students everywhere. Having that long view about people, but also about what it takes to change. And, you know, having come from New York, I have frequently said about the UC system that Glacial now overestimates the speed of the glaciers are disappearing faster than we change. Although, you know, tell me whether things are different with President Napolitano. But I think having that long view, and I frequently say at the end of some email where, you know, something's happened, I've gotten in the habit. I think there was a comedian, Rosanna Dana, from years ago, she'd say, if it's not one thing, it's another. I would say, there's always something. And a couple of my colleagues have said, now they all say, there's always something. So that's the job. It's not like, well, what do we think it would be, you know? I think that, you know, when you're moving from, as I am, from, you know, big fish in a small pool and, smaller fish in a big pool, I think it's going to be important for me to identify a couple of very clear, measurable, attainable goals and kind of be willing to commit to those and be public about it. So I just think that's a hallmark of good leadership. I'm not sure what that'll be. But I think when you make that jump, people expect that. And, you know, you have to embrace that. So I'm trying to do that. I also think, you know, leadership occurs in a context, and it's experienced in a lot of different ways in terms of the context, and, you know, it can be felt like this. Sometimes you do feel like you're out on your own. But I'm a fan of, because I have children and grandchildren, Lord of the Rings type of stuff, you know, so I think about if Bilbo Baggins said something like, I think it's time for another adventure, you know. And so it's great to have that option to have another adventure. And that I think, you know, certainly my time at UC and other places and then my insights so far about Long Beach is that you don't do this alone. You know, there's a team of people that are there to help you along the way. And, you know, really recognizing to develop that team and commit to that team and get the right people. You know, if you've read the book, Jim Collins has two books, Good to Great and Built to Last. I'd recommend that to anybody thinking about organizational development. And that. So I reflect on what UC has done for my career. Certainly, if I hadn't come to Santa Barbara, I wouldn't have met Amy Dorr, who wouldn't have invited me to go to UCR, so I wouldn't be president of Long Beach. Just wasn't going to happen, you know. So there's a serendipity of that. But there's also a generosity of mentorship and promotion of other people's careers that I think has characterized my experience at the UC system. Mark Udoff was tremendously supportive to me after trying to scare me the first time. But, you know, said something like, I heard you're doing well. This is at Riverside. I heard you're doing well. But that was only last week. I don't know about next week. Okay. I'll try one more week to do well. And I've already mentioned Henry Yang. And then, of course, having Tim White, you know, kind of reach back and invite me has made a big difference. But I think that context of promoting other people's careers is a lesson we can all learn. You know, they feel they're better for it, and obviously other people are better for it too. So, and I have to say that just the chance to think about this has been has made it more meaningful to me. So I appreciate the invitation and the chance to my think and my talk out loud to you about it. So thank you very much. Your questions or comments, or
yes, sir.
So, as you progress through the ranks of administration, what are some of the barriers you face?
You know, I would say this is one of the advantages of my women's only education. I was not as attentive. There were certainly a few things. So, one thing was. There was a moment when I was department chair at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and so I'm department chair, and then the head of our biggest and most important institute was a woman. She was at the Burroughs Institute of Mental Measurement. So here we are in the same department, and it was kind of cute because I was her boss as she was a faculty member. My boss. And we were saying to each other, who could manage this? Both each other's bosses. But we had this thing that we should go off and like learn to play golf. So we had a locker room together. That important thing happened for guys because they went off and they, you know, they played golf. We never did that. We found some bar. So I think I had the sense sometimes there was lack of access, that there were kind of affinity groups that had been defined by gender and by history, and I wasn't very easy to get access to that. I think sometimes it's the surprise that you that I experienced when people say, you did that? But inside of that is the message of is gender. So I don't think, especially at this point, you know, I have to say, early in my career, there were certainly, especially at Syracuse, I wouldn't say overt sexual harassment in the sense of quid pro quo, but this notion, I'll share it another vignette. So I was standing in the hall talking to a female graduate student, who was also a sorority at that point, which is so different now from psychology. And a male, a very senior male professor walked by and said something like, what are you women talking about? You should just get back to work. Yeah. And I reflected her. This is when it was still a joke, and it's certainly a joke, but no. So it was interesting. I mean, that was 1976, 1977, so that's a long time ago. And then, you know, I realized that once I became my department chair and then I'm a dean, momentum, you know, whether you're a man or a woman, you know. I think think there's access, though, that the sense sometimes I probably been as soon as I get on the train to go back to the airport, I'll see this.
Excuse me, on the phone, could you please mute? Thanks.
You mentioned that one of the things that you talked about in your interview for the Long Beach position was some of the ethical dilemmas that you had to deal with. I wonder if you're willing to talk about any of those, or more generally, talk about what the role of a leader is in an institution and kind of helping set the tone for how an institution deals with ethical issues.
I'll share with you one that I shared with the search committee that is long enough ago, and you know that in one of my leadership positions, faculty, you know, I have five departments and 250 faculty in a big place, but faculty in one department developed a mission statement that had a very explicit sexual orientation equality comment. And this didn't match state law. There was no such protection from state law for sexual orientation. But this faculty wanted to do that. Well, they kind of put it out there to the rest of the big college, and they started getting pushback from some other departments. And so I felt, normally, you know, as a dean, and you don't jump into every conversation and wait to see, not how it's going, but do they really need my voice? Because it's faculty. Faculty are going to talk to each other. They got big enough voices. But a moment came where I felt the ethical pull to make a statement about it doesn't matter if there's a state law or a federal law or, you know, in this school, here's what we'll do. We will never discriminate according to bisexual orientation, and we will monitor decisions made about outwardly gay, lesbian, transgender individuals to be sure that we didn't see any systematic bias. Well, I mean, all hell broke loose. I had the faculty for whatever god they had. I hate to blame a particular god since I don't think God's actually involved. I was actually mentioned on the Dr. Laura show, and she said it was that I had forced faculty to sign a pledge in favor of homosexuality. That's how it got interpreted. Yeah. So if I hadn't done that, I probably would have become provost there. But the outrage from the very conservative alums was such that. New York, they won't keep mind. When I think about how to do it, I should think about that. But I wouldn't undo it, because I think there's a point in leadership where, it is a judgment call. When is your voice necessary? And I felt that was an ethical dilemma. The other thing that's not, people often talk about personnel problems as if they're ethical. I don't think they all are, but sometimes there's an ethical problem with that personnel. I think the ethical thing, though, reflects back on this healthy community. I feel like I must talk to people about how they're doing. Normally I'm celebrating what they're doing, but I don't think it's fair or ethical or moral to allow people to kind of just hang out and not do well and fail and that they just never get the feedback. And I am really surprised at how frequent that is. It's easier not to tell people bad news, so we just don't tell anybody anything. So that's another part of, from my own moral compass, is to be straight. And it's difficult. It's very difficult. when it was clear that I wasn't going to be the chancellor at Riverside, I was on the road to actually making a very difficult personnel decision. And I thought, okay, I don't have to do that. And there was a moment where I actually have kind of beat myself up. I should have done that for the new person, but that's all. It's hard, even though I believe in it very strongly. Hard to do. Other comments or? Yeah, of course.
And,
women leaders often resolve conflict differently than many of their male counterparts, including leading to consensus building. Again, is able to foster consensus where there's very little or no compromise in situations where compromise is not appropriate. I want to know how it is done. Are there any strategies or tools to employ that we can model in our own practice?
This is from Dave Berquist, who's my counsel.
Yeah, he told me he was going to do that. I was about
the moment, I forgot.
So, yeah. So, early in my career as a psychologist, my scholarly area is mental health consultation. In other words, you know, we think about psychologists doing therapy. That's a certain kind of communication. But you spend a lot of your time actually not doing therapy with people, but you're in consultation with them about, you know, a better way to teach a class or a better way to, from a minister, a better way to talk to married couples. So I actually, it was a kind of a narrow, kind of special kind of interaction to have. And I was fascinated by this notion because I know, and a lot of studies support this, that, you know, given the mental health load among children and among adults, they're not seeing physicians or doctors, psychologists. They're with primary other kind of caregivers. And so how do we raise the level of capacity of caregivers? So that's kind of an obscure background to this. So I've actually spent a lot of time studying, doing research on this kind of communication where people come together, you're all at a kind of equal level, you have expertise in your area, I have expertise in mine. How do you get to a point where you're ready to do something different? And, you know, it won't surprise you that there's a basis of just listening. Most people don't listen, right? Most people just are quiet while somebody else is talking, and then they say what they were going to say. So learning to listen, and then building on the last thing that you heard or the consensus of the group, I hear us saying this, we're moving on, and really do it. Because some people often use this as a very shallow strategy. But, you know, I hear people in a group say, well, building on something Bill just said, and then they say something. They just learned that part. So really listening and really using that, you know, to build a scaffold in a sense of these ideas are already out here, and how are we going to pull them together? And then setting a standard for what the best behavior would be. So
when, I don't know if Dave was thinking about this, but
when we had this conversation, when I got to Riverside, I realized there was a project going forward that the deans didn't know anything about, and at least they said they didn't know anything about. there was building a solar array. And they, you know, so it comes down to, well, why are you doing that instead of doing something I need, right? Very reasonable question. So we had this discussion. Everybody was all over the place, but it, you know, made economic sense. We talked about that. And then, so we had this thing, and at the end I said something like, well, but we know it's the right thing, right? So we're the right thing. Maybe we think it's the right thing. Because you can, as a leader, you can set a standard. What's the right thing? You know? Yeah, there wasn't the right competition prior to the way we used the UCUA competition, which means sending everything to a message and doing what we wanted to do anyway. Not doing anything. So I think it is a process, and I would be happy to share if anybody's interested in that. I'm going to send Dave some. I have a new book that's almost ready now on using positive psychology and mental health consultation across many organizations. And it is, you know, it's the other thing is to find building on people's strengths. It's, you're already doing this, and so can you do just a little bit more of that? You know, and it's finding that. It takes a while to try to figure that out, but communication that's based on using the capacity in the room and doesn't always work, but it works more often than that.
Jane, thank you. That was one of the many examples that you that people reach consensus. So
you read that, David. I don't want to put you on the spot. The solar array discussion.
Yeah.
I hope it's up there.
It's there, and you have to come visit.
Yeah. Thank you, David.
Yes, I will have to give it.
Yeah, I still do some writing, but it, you know, it's derivative in the sense I'm reading other people's, you know, research, and I'm trying to put a particular frame. I'm married to a professor. He's doing original research, so I can take some, you know, launching some stuff. I think there was balance, but there was also, you know, a strong interest in organizational psychology, family therapy. Hey, if you want to be an administrator, study family therapy. And because the same dynamics, it doesn't matter. It's the family, it's the UC system. It's always the same dynamics. It's always about control, communication, who's in, who's out, sibling rivalry. It's always the same. And who's in charge? Do the parents have it together? You know. So I studied that, and that was helpful. But I may have told some of you this before, but I used to do, and early in my career, I was the director of the child and family clinic that we had at the University of Nebraska. So I actually saw clients. And the scariest client, you know, you have adolescents, out of control adolescents. Boys are a little scary because they will do crazy things. Girls are scarier. They'll come in with their mothers and they will say the worst, most horrible things to their moms. So I would say that experience, not exactly research, although we've been doing this for time, that experience of being in these highly conflictual, kind of almost out of control situations, feeling like I had to be the anchor in the room, I had to figure out how to, that's really helping, because as badly behaved, and any faculty member could be, they will never be as bad as a little boy. Never be that bad, you know. They will not knock things off the wall, they will not, you know. So that has, they never even came close. I have to say that. They never came close. But I think that tolerance for conflict is a real one. Seeing that and knowing you can live through it, you can reach, dealing with a couple who are totally at odds with one another, and you can find common ground. You know, that they may divorce and they can parent together. So that belief that if you work at it, you can find it. And you don't have to be scared by the level of, or the intensity of the emotion, I think was very, very helpful. I think we do, many of us get scared by the level of emotion and we back away from it. And not that I go seek it, you know, not suggesting that every meeting should be, you know, highly volatile, but I think sometimes we don't deal with the real question because we know it will be controversial. So there's another dean at Santa Barbara, so often, like, we'll be having a social gathering, and he'll notice that I've invited some people. He'll go, well, you can't have those two people together. Why not? Well, one's, you know, is political conservative, one's, well, I thought that's what we're about. We're a university. You know? But there's, you know, people do narrow things to avoid those confrontations. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your...
Thanks, David.